I was reading some old fables, and it was supposed to be like the top 40 fables that everybody should know. And one of them was about Alibaba and the 40 thieves. So I read it. I'd heard about it. I'd seen little cartoons about it. So I was interested in that. And part of the thing that is interesting in this, and it's really a life principle or a even broader than that, a Christian principle, something we can get a hold of, that is that everybody's life is influenced by other people, either negatively or positively. And there's kind of a different twist on this old story that I had heard before. And I had heard it, again, like in cartoon caricatures of it. But, you know, Open Sesame, you know, Alibaba and the 40 Thieves. And what happened was, in short, he solved the puzzle of the 40 thieves, and he learned the magic words, and he could open the cave to this untold wealth. And there's some intrigue, but at the end of the story, there's this little moral that is given. And that moral is simply this, that Alibaba, with wisdom, only went to the cave when the money was necessary, and he lived a modest, though well taken care of life. And he passed that secret on to the next generation and the next and the next. And again, all they learned was these two little words. But they also learned to be responsible with wealth and not to use it recklessly and self-indulgently, which is a good moral, I suppose. But we have something better to pass on than good stewardship or good work ethic, a religious bent, special words, an ample inheritance. We have something much more important to pass on and powerful to pass on than Open Sesame. Now, a lot of Christians, and if you read blogs or you do the television thing or however you get your religious fix, there's a lot of out there that's just fantasy faith. It's cotton candy Christianity. It's not substantial. It's not really anchored to the word. They use religious Bible phrases, but it's really just fantasy faith. It's Open Sesame. It's not the kind of life that you get because you are serious and working hard on a relationship with Jesus Christ. I mean, we can pass on something better than Open Sesame. We can pass along a fully surrendered life that wholeheartedly listens to the voice of God and knows clearly our assignments and joyfully accepts them and gets engaged in them. Alibaba passed along fantasy. We can pass along faith, but we have to pass it along. It's just not about me. It's about the next generation and the generation that follows after that. So we're going to go this morning into Caleb's dysfunctional life in Egypt. He's at the embryo stage of his leadership development. He's going to become a great leader in the wilderness and a fantastic model in Canaan. But now we're looking at how that leader is formed in the embryo of life. Time's necessary for his preparation. He's going to spend 40 years in Egypt. That's a lot of his life. He's going to be a baby, a teen. He's going to be someone who maybe gets married and becomes a leader in the community. So what I want to do, first of all, is show you that he's a product of his upbringing. We talk about nature and nurture. This is the nurturing part of him. First of all, he had a community heritage. He was part of Israel. They had been given special promises to Abraham, and it was passed on to a son, and then to another son, and then to another son, until those promises came to all of Israel and to Caleb himself. And in Numbers 13, and we're going to look at that more next week, but God says, send out some people. And one of the people that he is going to send out to spy out the land is going to be Caleb, because he's a leader. He's the head of the tribe of Judah. He's raised as a Hebrew in Egypt. He remembers, because he is a Hebrew, of the 12 prophecies that his ancestor Jacob gave on his dying bed. And to each one of his 12 sons, he gave a specific prophecy. And he remembers specifically the prophecy that was given to his ancestor Judah, that became the tribe of Judah, of which he's part of. And part of that prophecy is that there was someone that was coming who was going to be like a lion. And it wasn't fully developed. Looking back from the New Testament, we know that they're talking about Christ, the Messiah. But at that time, it was ambiguous. They didn't know. They just knew that the one was coming. Who's the one? Who's the lion? But that must have done something. So he's raised in this very religious environment. And he's also a product of special revelation, because in that same prophecy in Genesis 49:10 says, the scepter, that is the sword of sorts, will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from his descendants until the coming of the one to whom it belongs, the one whom all nations will honor. I mean, Caleb had this heritage of his community, Israel. But he also had this very special gift of knowing that an ancestor had made a prophecy based on special revelation from God. God spoke through Jacob to the nation of Israel, that is, to the offspring of Jacob, that someday the one was going to come. And so it's very special. When Caleb gets out of Egypt and he gets into the wilderness and then he gets into the promised land, he's going to have more than just special revelation where God speaks to individuals sometimes in an audible voice, sometimes through angels, through different means he speaks, but it's special. It's divine coming to humanity. But he's going to have something when he gets into the wilderness in Canaan that's called the Torah, the first 5 books of the Bible written by Moses. And of course, we have all of the Old Testament and the New Testament. We have special revelation. He's also a product of some God stories. And I don't know how he got his name, so I'm speculating a little bit here. But it seems that he was raised in a godly family, and the name that was chosen for him had some significance to the parents. The Jews liked to name their children after good things that were happening or bad things that were happening, but they liked to identify certain things by a name when they saw that child. And in his case, his name means dog, D-O-G. Woof, woof, dog, okay? You got what I'm talking about. I don't usually act out, but some of you didn't seem to understand. And it seems that it was kind of Jewish to always be mindful of yourself and of your children and your grandchildren. They didn't think of themselves as individuals, and that's the end of the story. That's American. Okay, that's how we are in our culture. It's me, what I think, what I want to do. They thought more broadly. They thought about themselves and how it impacted children and then grandchildren, Deuteronomy 4:9. But watch out. Be careful never to forget that you yourselves have seen. Do not let these memories escape from your mind as long as you live, and be sure to pass them on to your children and your grandchildren. And so he's in this religious family. They have a lot of specialness because they're not only Jewish, but they're from Judah. And now we get the name dog. Well, in the Bible, sometimes the word for dog is used for scavenger dogs. And in the New Testament, those who are outside the faith, who are living in perverted lives, And then sometimes they're sentinel dogs. That is, they're dogs that just guard the camp or the tent or the house or the sheep or whatever. And all their purpose is to just let you know that there's danger. But then also in the Bible, Job 30 verse 1, it talks about dogs of my flock. And that probably is where we're at. They weren't talking about a child, they name him dog because he yaps all the time whenever there's danger or because he was going to be a twisted child, but mainly because he was going to be a shepherding child. Dogs of my flock. The shepherd would walk ahead of the flock and behind would come the dog. And he would be protecting from wolves or from whatever, from people who might want to steal the sheep, and also making sure the sheep are moving and following the shepherd. They were trainable. They were faithful. They were loyal. They were obedient. They were under a master's control. The parents wanted a child that would be under the master's control, God's control. So it was really an affectionate name. It was a name that spoke of submission, the will of a dog that is not broken, but bent towards the master. Can hear the voice of the master, that can obey the voice of the master. So we say to a dog, come. If you have a dog like we've had in the past, he just sits there and says, until I see food, I don't do anything. But that's not a trained dog. Come and they come. Sit and they sit. Stay and they stay. It's an affectionate name of submission and of faithfulness. I've been watching some of these little blogs that are kind of interesting about like a dog who saves another dog that was drowning in a swimming pool. Maybe you've seen that. And then I saw a dog who had been trained to give CPR, and they show the man laying down there, and the dog is just jumping up with his front paws, just thumping his chest. Strange. At Maranatha Bible Camp, and we're thankful for those who represent Maranatha and are here today. We each summer, at least for the last couple of summers, there's been a little gal that comes, and she has a service dog. And the service dog can sniff when she's starting to move into a diabetic crisis, and just can tell, can sniff it out. So this, it's a good name. So the point here is he's in a community. He's in a family. He's given a name. So all of these things are good things, powerful things, community heritage and special revelation and stories about God and being named to move into the realm of being faithful to God. But also he was a product of some stuff that's sickening, that's dangerous, dysfunctional. So if somebody asked me my story, I can give it to you, I think, like in 90 seconds. Up until I was 8 or 9 years old, I was just a happy-go-lucky kid who played in the sand and with my cars and with my family and didn't think much about life, and nothing was going bad at all. Then around the age of 9 and 10, I started having things happen around me and to me. And I became a sad boy. I became a frightened boy. And then as I grew into my early teens, I got to a place when I was 12 years old where I was desperate to have some kind of safety in my life. And I went to a church in an evening service of the Berean Baptist Church in Brunswick, Maine, and my sister brought me and my older sister, and we went, and I encountered Christ. And I trusted Christ as my Savior, and life was radically different after that. But it didn't change overnight. And I remember the next 4 years, and a lot of just bizarre things were happening. And I came to a place when I was 16 years old where I made a decision to hear the voice of God and be obedient to it. At the same time that I was doing that, very sensitive to the Word of God, reading the Word and living in the Word and praying and wanting to be what the Word wanted me to be, at the very same moment I was making another decision. That was, life is so painful. I will never hurt like this again. And I walked away from my emotions. I cried when I was 16, but I didn't cry when I was 17 or 18 or 19 or 20 or 21 or 22 or 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30. I'm going to keep going. 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40. No more tears. Dysfunction will do that to you. By the way, I prayed for tears because I realized that other people had them, and it's kind of like if you're the odd man out. And it took me 3 or 4 years for God to answer that prayer. But I said, God, if I never shed a tear, I'll be as faithful as I can with or without them. Now, it's easier to just be faithful with them, by the way. But it's important to be faithful without them. So there was this dysfunction that he was raised in. He was raised as an Egyptian slave. They were at the bottom of the social pyramid. Most of the population in Egypt would have been slaves, but you need to think of the word serf. They kind of went with the land, but they could marry. They had medical care. Don't think of the Deep South before the Civil War and African Americans and that kind of bondage and that type of slavery. Don't think of slaves put on ships and some of them being thrown off overboard and dying in their chains in the ocean and those stories that are so horrendous. But they were serfs, peasants. They weren't educated. They weren't respected. They did have to work hard. They worked from sunrise to sunset. I mean, it was not a good life. But they could marry whoever they wanted. They could actually build wealth. They could do religious things. And because of the fertility of the land around the Nile, under normal circumstances, they had a good... None of them went hungry. They drank a form of beer that was kind of thick and mild and sweet and grainy, but they all had beer, and it was a drink that was common for all of the meals. It replaced water because water could sometimes be contaminated. But there was a minority of slaves that were under this lower than the serfs. And these were the slaves of the pharaoh or the royals or the elite. And they were criminals or they were captured in battle or they were designated enemies of the state in some way. And unfortunately, Israel was there. And that was Caleb. His parents and his grandparents and his great-grandparents, his aunts and his uncles, his cousins, his brothers, and sisters. In Exodus 3:17, I have promised to rescue you from your oppression in Egypt. They had real affliction. They needed to be rescued. God says, I will lead you into land flowing with milk and honey. So the Egyptians in Exodus 1:11 made the Israelites their slaves. They appointed brutal slave drivers over them, hoping to wear them down with crushing labor. But the more the Egyptians oppressed them, the more the Israelites multiplied and spread, and the more alarmed the Egyptians became. So the Egyptians worked the people of Israel without mercy. They made their lives bitter, forcing them to mix mortar and make bricks and do all the work in the fields. They were ruthless in all their demands. This affliction was real. The things that happened to you when you were a child and you should have been protected and you weren't, that's real affliction. It causes real pain. And it does cause a way of thinking. So I wonder, how will Caleb respond? How will you? Well, you kind of know, because I'm preaching this series, you know the story ends well, right? You know that in the wilderness, something good is going to happen. I mean, this isn't like it starts out bad, it gets worse, and then it's really ugly. No, it starts out really bad, but he makes some choices, and it becomes really good in the wilderness. He stands against the majority of people who are supposed to be wise and supposed to be the leaders. He stands against them. And then we'll get to him in his later years. So as the years go by, Exodus 2:23, they start praying. And they pray out of their pain. A lot of us pray out of our pain. But it says the Israelites continued to groan under the burden of slavery. They cried out for help, and their cry rose up to God. Now, I would like to say they prayed, and God gave an answer, and that's the story ends well. That's where it ends. But it doesn't. When you are a slave, it takes a long time to get the slave mentality out of you. It took a long time for me to get the dysfunction of how I was raised out of me. For years, when I was in my teens and in my 20s and 30s, I would shoot myself in the foot all the time. Now, how did I shoot myself in the foot? Yes, with my mouth. But they had this expectation that once they get God on their side, everything gets cleaned up automatically right now with a snap of the finger. God is God and he's sovereign, and a snap of the finger and it's all done. Now, a lesson I learned years ago was don't expect more from God the Father than what God the Father gave God the Son. There were many times when you would have hoped for Jesus Christ's sake, when he was living on this earth and when he was going to the cross, that with a snap of the finger, he wouldn't have to go through all that he would go through for us. Well, it says with regards to the children of Israel, when they Moses and Aaron, they're in Egypt and they're trying to lead them out. It says in verse 31 of chapter 4 of Exodus, and it speaks of Pollyanna hope. You know, false faith. You know, kind of this fantasy faith, this cotton candy Christianity. It says the people of Israel were convinced that the Lord had sent Moses and Aaron. It says that they were convinced, but I want you to know that subsequent to this statement, even though they believe and they are convinced, they're going to act as if they had never believed it at all. It's hard to get out of dysfunction. And you're invited into freedom. But it's hard to believe that that freedom is as free as the gospel offers it. Well, they had a Pollyanna hope because it isn't going to continue. Oh, thank you. This guy is a mind reader. What I like about him, because of his background, he puts a little vodka in it. You can't tell, but I can. And actually, it livens up my spirits. Anyway, okay. I'm just the mentoring pastor. I don't bear the responsibility of perfection the way I used to have. I grieve for Josh because now he has to be perfect. Anyway, this dysfunction, to get back to the seriousness of it, they had something that I had that many of you had, some of you still do. Exodus 6:9. So Moses told the people of Israel that when the Lord, what the Lord had said, but they refused to listen anymore. See, if it was a snap of the fingers, they believe and they're convinced. But once they have to endure any kind of hardship, any kind of length of time, it says they had become too discouraged by the brutality of their slavery. The English Standard Version has broken spirit. New American Standard, despondency. The Message, broken down in spirit. King James, anguish of spirit. However you want to take it, all those words mean something. They were broken people in their inner being, in their hearts, their souls, whatever you want to say, in their mind. They had a slave mentality. Dysfunction had branded them and seared them and scarred them. They were a product of being Jewish, of God speaking to their ancestors, of parents speaking into their life with God stories and giving the right kind of name. But they also were products of cultural contamination. They were a product of slave mentality. And they were convinced, but it was really a life of little yeses and lots of no's. It was yes when it was convenient. It was yes when they were going to get what they wanted, when they wanted, how they wanted it. But just little yeses to God. It was going to be a life of struggle and stumbling for 40 years in the wilderness. They're going to struggle with a misplaced antagonism, and I struggled with that. If there ever was a mom that should have been appreciated by her children, it should have been my mom. Divorced, trying to raise three kids, trying to hold, and welfare system was different. We lived on welfare, but she had to work sometimes three jobs. But I was so angry at my mom. I was angry at other people that didn't even seem rational, but sometimes you get angry at the wrong people. It says in Exodus 5:21, the foreman said to them, "May the Lord judge and punish you for making us stink before Pharaoh and his officials," that is, the leaders, the foremen of the slaves, who are slaves themselves, are looking at Moses and Aaron, and they're doing what God says. They're doing what will rescue them. They're doing what is good for them. And yet they come back to Aaron and Moses, and they say, "You're making us stink. You've put a sword into their hands, an excuse to kill us." This slave mentality, you fight often against the wrong people. And you have this kind of, this slavery mentality gives you a bent, a slavery bent, and you bend back to the dysfunction. There's something in the dysfunction that makes you feel comfortable because it's knowable. It's predictable. But it's slavery. So after Moses and Aaron had performed all of those 10 plagues and miracles that were astonishing, and after they were brought out of Egypt in this marvelous celebration of deliverance and God parts the Red Sea, they'd much rather be slaves than be free. They can't really embrace their freedom. They can't embrace maturity. They always want to have the safe structure that they're comfortable with. So Exodus 14:12, "Didn't we tell you this would happen while we were still in Egypt? We said, 'Leave us alone. Let us be slaves to the Egyptians.' It's better to be a slave in Egypt than a corpse in the wilderness." And they struggle with false memories. So hard times, because they weren't mature, would force them into false memories, recreating the past. And they longed for slavery. They longed to go back. "If only the Lord had killed us back in Egypt," they moaned. "There we sat around pots filled with meat, ate all the bread we wanted. But now you've brought us into this wilderness to starve us all to death." They struggle with trusting authority. Exodus 17:3, but tormented by thirst, they continued to argue with Moses. The one God had sent, the one that God had spoken, the one that God had empowered, the one that God had used to free them from the yoke of Pharaoh and to bring them into the across the Red Sea in that marvelous miracle and into the wilderness. And they had seen water miraculously come. They couldn't trust him now. Any little thing. Because they're still a slave in their heart, in their soul. They haven't really left Egypt. Now, physically they have, but mentally and spiritually they're still back in Egypt. And there were several years, though I had left Maine, my slavery mentality was still tied up in Maine. In this house, in that house, in this event, in that thing that happened, in this thing that happened. And then, because they are immature, they struggle with never being satisfied. Numbers 11:5, we remember. Same old thing, same old thing, same old thing. False memories, can't trust, all of that kind of stuff. We remember the fish we used to eat for free. It was free. They didn't have to pay for it. It was just given to them because they were slaves. We had all the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlics we wanted. It was a fertile place. Slaves didn't go hungry. But now our appetites are gone, whiny, whiny, whiny. All we see is this manna. What? They saw God provide a miraculous manna, a miraculous bread, a substance that was good to the taste. But all they couldn't see the hand of God in that provision. They forgot all the miracles of Egypt, the parting of the Red Sea, the deliverance from the enemy, this miraculous bread, the Shekinah glory on Mount Sinai, all in just a few months. We're not talking a great period of time here. They are still slaves in their heart and in their soul. They couldn't appreciate what God had done, what he was doing, what he will do. They had all these false memories of Egypt. Well, three quick observations. Observation number one, we need to trust God's promises. You need to get to a place where you say, I will trust. When I was 16 years old, hitchhiking on an intersection in Brunswick, Maine, I wrestled with whether I was going to honor my mother and my father. And I said, I can honor my mom. That seems clear. But why would I honor my dad? This, this, and this. And I chose to honor him because the Bible said it. You got to choose. You got to grow through your present pain. Look what it says of God. I've certainly seen the oppression. I've heard their cries of distress. I'm aware of their suffering. I've promised to rescue. I will lead you to a land that's flowing with milk and honey. You got to trust God. He has a plan. It just doesn't happen like this, though. He knows what he's doing. He's going to take the right amount of time for your sake and for the sake of others. Then you need to trust the next generation. Some people invest in the next generation. Gerald Bradley, the first man who invested in me. I have very few pictures of him. This is one I do like because that's just about how I remember him always. A smile, a cheerful heart. He didn't break my spirit. He brought life to my heart. And some of you parents are breaking the spirit of your children. Some of you have had your spirit broken by your parents. Oh, but a cheerful heart, that's good medicine. But who can bear, who can stand, who can live with a broken spirit? Moses mentored Caleb, and Caleb is going to mentor the first judge of Israel when we get to the book of Judges. They gave them their spiritual passions, and they fell in love with Jehovah God, but they didn't break their spirit with rules and regulations and law. bringing them into bondage of legalism. Gerald Bradley had his own set of circumstances. He was adopted. He was single, never married. And he could invest in people. He's the one that taught me how to play chess. I lost 50 games of chess to him before I learned to win. And I also learned not to let everybody who plays chess with me, even when they're little, to always win. There's something about losing, realizing that there's more to the game. His library. A third of my books up on the third floor came out of his library. Taught me how to be committed to a group of fellowship of churches. He was conservative Baptist, God forgive him. He taught me to love Child Evangelism Fellowship. He took me to the camps, introduced me to the workers. I got involved. That's why I love CEF to this day and appreciate it. And I appreciate those who are invested in it. He gave me a heart for sheep. He preached 22-minute messages almost always. He always used the Lord's Prayer. He was as traditional a guy as you could ever admit. But he didn't try to make me into him. He tried to release me to be what Christ wanted me to be. And I thought over the years, I don't know how it would work in heaven, but he might be standing before Christ. And Christ would say in kind of a sly little way, Jerry, come here. I want to give you a glimpse of what your life did. Your investment. And he didn't just invest in me, but he did invest in Richard Crock. And I want to show you some things. I want to show you dozens of churches and hundreds of churches and thousands of lives that have been changed in Egypt. Not in Egypt, but in India. I want to show you this. Look at Maranatha. These decades he's been involved in Maranatha. And look at the thousands of lives that have been changed. Look at the local churches he has been involved in at Scotts Bluff or Torrington and Cheyenne. And look at the lives that have changed. That's because of you. You had your part. This week, I got a couple of different posts on Facebook, Messenger, you know, kind of thing. And one was, you know, 25 years ago when I was a young pastor, you said this. 25 years later, I want to celebrate and I want to show you what's happening. Well, you need to trust your victory. I've given you a card that I would like you to all promise before you and God, if it be you're so inclined to say, God, when I have time, I'm going to take a look through this little thing. I don't have time to read it with you, but I do want to read some, and then we're done. This is what I want to read. First of all, we don't receive a spirit that makes us fearful slaves. When we become born again, we really get something new. It makes a difference. And I am so pleased to call God my Father, Abba, Father. See, we're all recovering from some kind of slavery, mental slavery, spiritual slavery. We're all bound to some fear rather than faith. We're all needing control rather than surrendering control. We're all discontented at times rather than enjoying a restful contentment. But I want to read to you part of Psalm 78 as we close. And that's this. These are selected verses because you have to choose between victimhood, being a victim, or victory, being a victor in Christ. So listen to this sad, sad, sad commentary on the people of Israel and on some of you, your life. And I want to suggest as we read this, it doesn't have to stay this way. So each generation should set his hope anew on God, not forgetting his glorious miracles and obeying his commands. This is Psalm 78, now verse 8. Then they will not be like their ancestors, stubborn, rebellious, and unfaithful, refusing to give their hearts to God. My dad, maybe your dad. Verse 11, they forgot what he had done, the great wonders he had shown them. Verse 17, yet they kept on sinning against him, rebelling against the Most High in the desert. Verse 18, they stubbornly tested God in their hearts, demanding the foods they crave. Verse 20, yes, he can strike a rock so water gushes out, but he can't give this people meat and bread. But in spite of this, verse 32, the people kept sinning. Despite his wonders, they refused to trust him. Verse 36, but all they gave him was lip service. They lied to him with their tongues. Verse 37, their hearts were not loyal to him. They did not keep his covenant. Verse 40, oh, how often they rebelled against him in the wilderness and grieved his heart in the dry wasteland. Again and again they tested God's patience and provoked the Holy One of Israel. Verse 42, they did not remember his power and how he rescued them from their enemies. This little card has been really helpful to people over the years, and I'm hoping it'll be helpful to some of you again. It's who I am in Christ, your identity. I'm God's child. I'm Christ's friend. I've been justified. Who I am, how I'm accepted, that I'm secure, that I'm significant. I am the salt and the light of the earth. I'm a branch of the true vine. I've been chosen and appointed to bear fruit. We're going to close with a song that I've asked specifically to close with the next three Sundays. It's a song that our worship pastor, Kai Schoen, wrote, and it reminds us that we don't have to live as slaves.
I always think it's important to just begin this closing with just a brief period of reflection. And so as we close out the service, just take the first part of this song and remember that you can be the victor through Christ. And then respond to the song.
I can hear you speak. Your words I will seek, and I will walk with you. And I can hear you say, you're the
Dismissed.